From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Waxworks by Robert Bloch. It had been a dull day for Bertrand before his discovery of the waxworks, a dark, foggy day which he had spent in tramping aimlessly about the dingy streets of the Quay district he loved. It had been a dull day, but nonetheless it was of a sort that Bertrand's imaginative nature best loved. He found a morose enjoyment in the feeling of the stinging sleet upon his face, like to the sensation of semi-blindness induced by the nebulosity of outline conjured up with the fog. Mist made the dingy buildings and the narrow streets that threaded crookedly between them seem unreal and grotesque. The commonplace stone structures squatted in blueness like vast inanimate monsters carved from cyclopean stone. So, at least thought Bertrand, in his somewhat maudlin fashion, for Bertrand was a poet, a very bad poet, with a sentimentally esoteric nature such beings affect. He lived in a garret in the dock district, ate crusts of bread, and fancied himself very much put upon by the world. In moments of self-pity, which were frequent, he made certain mental comparisons between his estate and that of the late François Villon. These estimates were none too flattering to the latter gentleman, for after all, Villon had been a pimp and a thief, whereas Bertrand was neither. Bertrand was just a very honorable young man whom people had not yet learned to appreciate, and if he starved now, posterity would spread him a pretty feast. So his thoughts ran a good part of the time, and days of fog like this were ideal for such personal compassions. It was warm enough in Bertrand's garret, and there was food there, for after all, his parents in Marseille did send him money regularly under the impression that he was a student at the college. Yes, the garret was a fine refuge on such a dismal afternoon, and Bertrand could have been hard at work on one of those noble sonnets he was always intending to produce. But no, he must wander about in the fog and think things out for himself. It was so romantic, he grudgingly conceded, in his mind, for he hated to use trite expressions. This romantic phase was beginning to pall on the young man after an hour's walk about the wharves. Sleet and drizzling rain had dampened more than his ardor. Then, too, he had just discovered in himself a most unpoetic case of the sniffles. In consequence, he was more than heartened by the sight of the dim lamp that shone through the murk from a dark basement doorway between two houses on this obscure side street. The lantern served to illuminate a sign proclaiming waxworks within. Upon reading this legend, Bertrand felt a faint tinge of disappointment. He had hoped that the beacon ornamented the door of a tavern, for our poet was given to the bottle at those odd times when he found himself in funds. Nonetheless, the light was a symbol of warmth and shelter within, and perhaps the waxworks would be interesting. He went down the steps, opened the dark door, and stepped shivering slightly at the sudden change into a warm, dimly lit hallway. A little fat man in a greasy cap shuffled out from behind a side door and took his 3 francs with a shrug of surprise, as if wordlessly indicating his amazement at securing a customer at such a time. Bertrand glanced down the plain hall as he removed his wet jacket. His fastidious nose wrinkled slightly at the musty odor about the place. This, combined with a peculiar acridity, common only to discarded wet garments in a warm room, gave the air a genuine museum smell. As he walked down the hall to the wide doorway leading into the exhibit, he was conscious of a subtle heightening of his melancholy, which the fog had so visibly augmented. Here in this shabby darkness he felt a profound spiritual depression. Without knowing, he slipped from self-dramatization into reality. His mind craved morbidity. His thoughts were steeped in umber stillness. Steeped in umber stillness. He must remember that and write it down. He was, in point of fact, quite properly in the mood for the waxworks exhibit, which he now beheld. It was a carnival of the gruesome and the macabre. Once, in a moment of temporary affluence, Bertrand and a feminine companion had visited the great Madame Tussaud's. His memories of the occasions were vague, and dealt more fully with the charms of the young lady than with the rather inanimate attractions of the statuary. But as he recalled it, the wax figures had been those of historically prominent and journalistically notorious personages, representations of generals and statesmen and movie stars. This had been Bertrand's sole experience in viewing such objects, save for the odious Punch and Judy displays and the traveling carnival companies he visited during his far-off childhood. He was 23. A casual glance served to show that these waxworks were of a vastly different nature. A long, vast chamber stretched before him. A surprisingly large chamber for such an obscure enterprise, he thought. It was low-ceilinged, and the fog outside the narrow windows lent an effective dimness to the already poor lighting arrangements, so that the atmosphere was one of profound gloom appropriate to the scene. An army of still white figures paraded in arrested processional against the dingy walls, an army of stiffly staring corpses, an army of mummified, embalmed, petrified, ossified. He ran out of descriptive terminology and realized guiltily that his words were pitifully inadequate to describe the impressiveness of these silent wax figures. They held an attitude of arrested motion, which in turn captured a peculiar feeling of ominous waiting. They seemed to have just died, or rather to have been frozen in some airy, invisible ice that was about to melt and release them once again at any moment. For they were realistic, and the lighting effects of the room disguised what crudities and blemishes might exist. Bertrand began to walk along the left wall and gazed intently at each figure or group of figures. The subject matter of these exhibits was harrowing in the extreme. Crime was the theme, perverse and dreadful crime. The monster Landru crept upon a sleeping wife in the night, and see, the maniac Toulouse lurks with bloody knife behind the barrels as his tiny son descends the cellar stairs. Three men sit with an open boat, and one is armless, legless, headless, while the others feast. Gilles de Retz stands before the altar, and his beard is dabbled red as he holds his basin high. The sacrifice lies broken at his feet. A woman writhes upon the wheel, and the sharp-fanged rats race round and round the dungeon floor. Flayed alive is he that hangs upon the gibbet, and giant Dessalines advances with a leaded whip. The murderer Vardac stands accused, while from his suitcase trickles a red stain. The fat monk, Omolie, digs within his crypt amidst the barrels of bones. Here sleeping evil rises from hidden depths in men's souls, and slyly grins. Bertrand saw and shuddered. There was a disturbingly artful verisimilitude in the depiction of these frights which made him ill at ease. They were so cunningly, so artfully conceived. The details of background and setting seemed minutely authentic, and the figures themselves seemed to be the products of a master craftsmanship. Their simulation of life was startling. Their molder had instilled genuine action into pose and posture, so that each pictured movement was actually portrayed. And the heads, with the expressions on the faces, were astonishingly real. They glared and twisted with rage, lust, anger, contorted and blenched with fear, shock, agony. The eyes stared with a more than glassy reality. The hair hung naturally from bearded cheeks, lips opened as though warm with breath. So they stood, the waxwork figures, each living eternally the supreme moment of the horror, which justified their existence as images and damned their souls as living men. Bertrand saw them. Little signs proclaimed the characters in each picture melodrama suitably grandiloquent style, and cards recited bloody histories of famous misdeeds. Bertrand read them self-consciously. He knew that what he saw was cheapest theatricalism, sensational yellow journal stuff at its worst, the type of lurid gore parading in which the moron mind delights. But he fancied that there was something rather grand about this whole insane array of melodramatics. They seemed to have a certain intensity which ordinary life shuns to express in daily action. He wondered, as he stared, whether or not this feeling of intensity was one of the attractions for the ordinary foolish sensation hunters, Whether or not they felt it and were vaguely envious of its contrast to their sedulously eventless lives. And he almost chuckled when he realized that the pictured scenes were real, that their counterparts had actually existed. Moreover, were still existing today in 100 hidden places. Yes, murderers and rapists and mad fiends crouched unknown, even now, waiting to strike. Some of them would be exposed, others die in secrecy inviolate, but their deeds went on, their gory melodramatic deeds. The young poet walked on. He was all alone in this room, and the sight of the blue fog fingers still clawing at the window panes encouraged him to take his leisure. He spent much time in noting the perfections of the figures, gradually approached the right wall of the hall, which seemed to have given over to the bloody scenes of actual recorded history, the burnings, pillagings, tortures, and massacres of olden times. Here, too, he was forced to concede admiration for the designers of the displays. Historical costuming was splendid throughout. There must be many details to this waxwork-making business, he thought, as he examined the particularly noteworthy figure of the Emperor Tiberius Caesar at sport in the torture chamber. Then he saw her. She was standing, statue still straight and poised and lovely. She was a girl, woman, goddess, imperially slender with the delicious curves of a succubus fashioned in dreams. Bertrand's poet eyes dying to notice actual physical details, though his bemused brain must translate them anew into elaborate imagery. Thus her splendid auburn hair was a crimson cloud, her smiling, finely chiseled face a mask of enchantment, her starry blue eyes twin pools in which a soul must drown. Her parted lips were curved as though in voluptuous delight, and from them her tongue protruded like a little red dagger, whose stab was joy. She wore a filmy, bejeweled robe of sorts, which only served to accentuate the white beauty of the body it half revealed beneath. Actually, she was a very pretty red-headed woman, and she was wax, common, ordinary wax, very much of the sort which had served to fashion the form of Jack the Ripper. Her pose was commonplace, but arresting. She stood tiptoe with outstretched arms that held a silver salver, stood before King Herod on his throne, for she was Salome, wanton of the seven veils, white witch and wooer of all evil. Bertrand stared into her wicked oval face, the eyes of which seemed to flicker with amusement in returning his gaze. And he thought that she was the most beautiful creature he had ever beheld, and the most dreadful. Her slim hands held a silver platter, and on it rested a severed head, the gory decapitated head of John the Baptist, lying with stony eyes, death bright in a pool of blood. Bertrand didn't move. He simply looked at the woman. A queer impulse to address her came over him. She was mocking his goggle-eyed gazing. She thought him rude. Speak, man. He wanted to tell her that he loved her. Bertrand realized this with a thrill of pain that was almost horror. He did love her. Love her wildly beyond all dreams of love. He wanted her. This woman who was only wax. It was torture to look at her. The ache of her beauty was intolerable when he realized that she was unattainable. What irony. To fall in love with a waxwork, he must be mad. But how poetic it was. Bertrand pondered, and not so highly original at that. He'd read of similar cases, seen some claptrap dramatizations of the theme, which is as old as Pygmalion and his statue. Reason wouldn't help him. He realized with a sort of despair he loved her beauty and her menace, always would. He was that sort of poet. It was amazing finally to glance up and see the sun sullenly shining through the windows from which fog had fled. How long had he been gaping here? Bertrand turned away, after one last soul-wrenching look at the object of his adoration. I'll come back, he whispered. Then he blushed guiltily to himself and hurried down the hall to the door. 2. He came back the next day, and the next. He became familiar with the pudgy gray features of the little fat man who seemed to be the sole attendant at the door. Grew to know the dusty museum and its contents. He learned that visitors were scarce these days and discovered late afternoon was the ideal time for his hours of worship. For worship it was. He would stand silently before the cryptically smiling statue and stare enraptured into the maddening cruelty of her eyes.
Sometimes he would mumble bits of the verse with which he struggled by night. Often he would plead mad lover's entreaties meant for waxen ears. But red-haired Salome only stared back at him in return and regarded his ravings with a set and cryptic smile. It was odd that he never inquired about the statue or any of the others until one day he spoke with a little fat attendant. The squat gray-haired man approached him one day at twilight and entered into conversation, thus ending a reverie in a manner which greatly annoyed the lovesick Bertrand. "Pretty, hm?" said the gray-haired man in the coarse, vulgar voice such unfeeling dolts habitually possess. "I modeled her from my wife, you know." "His wife? His wife? This shabby little old fat fool?" Bertrand felt that he was really going mad, until the next words of his companion dispelled the notion. "Years ago, of course." "But she was alive? Real? Alive?" His heart leaped. "Yes. She's dead a long time now, of course. Dead. Gone. As far away as ever. Only this taunting waxen figure remaining. Bertrand must talk to this little fool. Draw him out. There was so much he had to know, but in a moment he found that there was no need to draw out his companion. Loneliness evidently begot garrulity upon the little man's part. He mumbled on in his gruff, crude fashion. "Clever work, isn't it?" The gray-haired adult was surveying the wax figure in a manner which Bertrand found peculiarly repulsive. There was in his eyes no adoration for the being represented, only the unfeeling appraisal of a craftsman commenting on his handiwork. He was admiring the wax, not the woman. "My best," mused the little man. And to think that he had once possessed her! Bertrand was sickened dreadfully at the fellow's callousness, but the man did not seem to notice. He kept glancing from the statue to Bertrand and back again, meanwhile keeping up a steady stream of comment and information. "Monsieur must be interested in the museum, hmm? He seemed to be a frequent visitor. Good work, wasn't it? He, Pierre Jacquelin, had done it all. Yes, he had learned the waxworks business well in the past 8 years. It cost money to hire assistants, so save for occasional group pieces, Jacquelin had fashioned all the figures himself. People had done him the honor of favorably comparing his work to Tissot's. No doubt he could get a place on the staff there, but he preferred to run a quiet business of his own. Besides, there was less notoriety. But the figures were good, weren't they? That's where his medical knowledge served him. Yes, it had been Dr. Jacquelin in the old days. Monsieur admired his wife, didn't he? Well, that was not strange. There had been others. They, too, came regularly. No? No need to take offense. It would be silly to be jealous of a wax image. But it was peculiar the way men still came, some of them not even knowing about the crime. The crime? Something in the little man's grave face, as he mentioned it, caused Bertrand to prick up his ears, to ask questions. The old fellow showed no hesitation in answering. "Can it be that you do not know?" he said. "Oh, well, time passes, and one forgets the newspapers." It was not a pleasant thing. I wanted to be alone then, and the notoriety caused me to abandon practice. That is how I began here, to get away from it all. She caused it. He pointed at the statue. The Jacquelin case, they called it, because of my wife, you know. I knew nothing until the trial. She was young, alone in Paris when I married her. I knew nothing of her past. I had my practice, I was busy, away a great deal of the time. I never suspected. She was pathological, monsieur. I had suspected certain things from her conduct, but I loved her and never guessed. I brought a patient to the house, an old man. He was quite ill, and she nursed him very devotedly. One night I came in quite late and found him dead. She had cut his throat with a surgical knife. I came upon her silently, you understand, and she was attempting to go further. The police took her away. At the trial, it all came out. About the young fellow at Brest she had done in, and the two husbands she had disposed of at Lyons and Liege, and she confessed to other crimes, five in all, decapitation. Oh, I was broken up over it, I can tell you. That was years ago. I was younger then. I loved her. And when she admitted that she had planned to finish me off next, I felt, well, never mind. She had been a good wife, you see, quiet and gentle and loving. You can see for yourself how beautiful she was. And to discover that she was mad, a murderess like that, it was terrible. I did my best. I still wanted her after all that. It is hard to explain. We tried to plead insanity, but she was convicted and they sent her to the guillotine. How badly he tells the story, thought Bertrand. Material for tragedy here. He bungles it into a farce. When will life live up to art? My medical practice was ruined, of course. The papers, the publicity, that was fatal. I lost everything. Then I began this. I made plaster bust, medical figures, turn a little extra through the years. So I took my savings and began the museum. All these misfortunes had upset me, I can tell you, and I was in a bad way when I started. I had become interested in crime, for obvious reasons. That is why I specialized in this sort of thing. The little man smiled a bit tolerantly, as though in memory of things long dead and forgotten emotions. He tapped Bertrand on the chest with a jollity which the latter found hideous. What I did was a capital joke. I got permission from the authorities to go down to the morgue. The execution had been delayed, and my business here was well started. I had learned my technique, so I went down to the morgue after the guillotining, understand, and made a model of my wife. From life, or death rather, yes, I made the model, and it's a grand joke. She had beheaded, and now she was beheaded. So why not make her Salome? John the Baptist was beheaded too, wasn't he? Quite a jest. The little man's face fell a bit, and his pale gray eyes grew bright. Perhaps it wasn't such a joke, monsieur. To tell the truth, at that time I did it for revenge. I hated her for the way she had broken my life, hated her because I still loved her, in spite of what she had done. And there was more irony than humor in my doings. I wanted her in wax to stand here and remind me of my life, my love, and her crime. But that was years ago. The world has forgotten, and I have too. Now she is just a beautiful figure, my best figure. Somehow, I have never again approached the art, and I think you will agree with me that it is art. I've never achieved such perfection, though I've learned more mastery with the years. Men come in and stare at her, you know, the way you do. I don't believe many of them know the story, but if they did, they would still come. You will come again, won't you, even though you know? Bertrand nodded brusquely as he turned and hurried away. He was playing the fool, rushing out like a child. This he knew, and he cursed himself under his breath even as he ran from the museum and the hateful little old man. He was a fool. His head throbbed. Why did he hate the man, her husband? Why did he hate her because she had once lived and killed? If the story were true, it was. He remembered something of the Jacqueline case, vague headlines dimmed by the passage of years. He had probably shuddered over the penny dreadful newspaper versions as a boy. Why did he feel as though he were in torment? A wax statue of a dead murderess, made by her stupid and insane brute of a husband? Other men came and stared. He hated them, too. He was losing his mind. This was worse than silly. It was insane. He must never go back there, must forget all about the dead and the loss that could never be his. Her husband had forgotten. The world had not remembered. Yes, he had made his decision, never again. He was very glad that the place was deserted the next day, as he prayed before the silent, red-haired beauty of Salome. 3. A few days later, Colonel Bertrand came to his lodging. An insufferable bore, the colonel, a close friend of his family, a retired officer and a born meddler. It did not take Bertrand long to discover that his worried parents had sent the colonel down to reason with him. It was the sort of thing they would do, and the sort of thing a pompous ass like the old colonel would enjoy doing. He was brusque, dignified, pedantic. He called Bertrand my dear boy, and wasted no time in coming to the point. He wanted Bertrand to give up his foolishness and return home to settle down. The family butcher shop, he belonged to, not in a Paris attic. No, the colonel was not interested in his poetry scribbling. He came to reason with Bertrand. And more of the same thing, until Bertrand was half frantic with exasperation. He could not insult the old daughter, try as he may. The man was too stupid to understand his satirical deprecations. He followed Bertrand about the streets when he ate, and took it for granted that he was invited. He put up at a nearby hostelry, and spent his first night in conversation. He was absurdly confident that the dear boy would heed his wisdom. Bertrand gave up after that evening. The colonel put in his appearance again at noon, just as Bertrand was about to leave for the museum. Despite pointed hints, Colonel Bertrand would be only too glad to accompany him to the waxworks. He did. Once inside the place, Bertrand sank into the strange mood of mysterious excitement he had now learned to expect. No, to hunger for. The colonel's asinine commentaries on the criminal displays he was able to ignore. His reveries drowned out the conversational background. They approached her. Bertrand said nothing, stood silent on the spot, though his eyes cried out. He gazed, devoured, she mocked. Silently they duelled as minutes fled down the path of eternity. Abruptly Bertrand jerked back to consciousness, blinking like a sleeper just awakened from an enthralling and ecstatic dream. Then he stared. The colonel was still beside him. He was gaping at the statue of Salome with utter bemusement. On his face was a look of wonder, so alien and somehow youthful that Bertrand was amazed. The man was fascinated. As fascinated as he was. The colonel? It was impossible. He couldn't have, not he. But he had. He was. He felt it. Loved her, too. Bertrand wanted to laugh at first. But as he looked into that utterly absorbed old face once again, he felt that tears might be more appropriate. He understood. There was something about this woman that called forth the dreams buried in the soul of every man, old or young. She was so gorgeously aloof, so wickedly wanton. Bertrand glanced again at her evil tenderness, noted the shapely grace with which she stood, holding that horrid head. That horrid head! It was different today, not the black-haired, blue-eyed, glassy-staring head he had seen on previous visits. What was wrong? A touch on his shoulder. The little gray-haired owner of the waxworks, horribly solicitous. Noticed it, he mumbled. Deplorable accident. The old head was accidentally broken. One of her gentleman friends tried to poke it with an umbrella, and it fell. I substituted this while repairing the original. But it does detract. Colonel Bertrand had glanced up from his shattered reveries. The little gray-haired man fawned on him. Pretty, began. I modeled her from my wife, you know. And he proceeded to tell the whole grim story, just as Bertrand had it from him a week before. He told it just as badly, and in practically the same words. Bertrand watched the sick, hurt look on the colonel's face and wondered with a start if he had not appeared much the same way when he listened for the first time. In curious parallel to his own behavior, it was the colonel who turned on his heel and walked away at the conclusion of the narrative. Bertrand followed, feeling the eyes of the little gray man, appraising the departing backs in a quizzical fashion. They reached the street and walked in silence. The colonel's face still wore a dazed expression. At the door of his lodging, the colonel turned to him. His voice was curiously hushed. I think I'm beginning to understand, my boy. I'll not trouble you again. I'm going back. He marched up the street, shoulders strangely erect, leaving Bertrand to ponder. Not a word about the waxworks incident. Nothing. But he loved her, too. Strange. The whole affair was strange. Was the colonel going away or fleeing? The little man had retold his story with such curious readiness. It was almost as though he had rehearsed it. Could it be that the entire business was a hoax of some sort? Perhaps it was all a fabrication, a clever ruse on the part of the museum keeper. Yes, that must be the explanation. Some artist had sold him the wax figure. He noted that its realistic beauty attracted lonely men and concocted the story of a notorious murderess to fit the statue's history. The case might be real enough, but the little man did not look as though he had ever been the husband of a murderess. Not her husband. The story was just bait, a lure to keep the men coming, keep their money rolling in. With a start, Bertrand computed the amounts of francs he had spent within the museum these past weeks. It was considerable. Clever schemer. Still, the real attraction lay in the statue itself. The figure was so beautiful, so alive in its loveliness, through which there breathed a sort of alluring wickedness. Salome was a red witch, and there was a mystery in her which Bertrand felt he was soon to penetrate. He had to understand that smile and its spell over him. So thinking, he retired. And the next few days he wrote. He started an epic poem of surprising promise and labored without pause. He was thankful the colonel had left, grateful to her for helping. Perhaps she did understand, perhaps she was real. Mayhap she heard his wild mutterings in the night, his lonely entreaties cast up to the stars. Perchance in some far-off poet's Avalon she waited, or in some flaming poet's hell, he would find her. He told her that the next day, when he thanked her for removing Colonel Bertrand, he was going to recite to her a stanza of his sonnet, when he became aware that the eyes of the museum keeper rested on him from a distance down the hall. He ceased his mutterings, crimson with shame. Spying on him? How often had he gloated over the anguish of the poor wretches enmeshed in her beauty? Withered little beast! Bertrand tried to look away. He stared at the new head of John the Baptist. Substitute? He wondered under what circumstances the original had been cracked. Some fool with an umbrella, the little man had said, trying to touch her, as though such a desire were granted a mere mortal. This substitute head was fine, although as realistic as the first. The closed eyes of the blonde young man lent a rather morbid note, lacking in the pallid stare of the other. Still, it was not exactly John the Baptist. The little man was still staring. Bertrand cursed under his breath and turned away. No more peace today. He hurried down the hall, trying to appear oblivious. As he neared the door, he bent his head and sought to avoid the stare of the keeper. In doing so, he almost ran into the oncoming figure of a visitor. He muttered a hasty, "Your pardon, please," and left. Turning back, he gazed with a shock at the retreating back of the man he had jostled. Was he mad? Or did he perceive the shoulders of Colonel Bertrand? But Bertrand had left. Or had he? Was he lured back to worship in privacy as Bertrand worshipped, as others did? Would the little old man stare at him as Salome stared another? Bertrand wondered. The next few days he came at odd hours, hoping to encounter the colonel. He was interested. He wanted to question the older man, seek to learn if he too were affected by his puzzling infatuation for a waxen image. Bertrand could have questioned the little gray museum keeper concerning his friend, but he felt a vague dislike for the fellow which restrained him. If the keeper's story were a hoax, he hated the imposture. If true, he could not forgive him for having known, for having embraced a beauty Bertrand would have given his life to possess. The poet left the museum in a state of mental anguish. He hated the place, hated its keeper, hated her, because his love chained him. Must he come back to this dark old dungeon forever, mutely suffering away his life for a glimpse of beauty forever denied him? Must he walk past mocking murderers in gloom to gaze into the eyes of his waxen tormentress? How long? The mystery was unseating his reason. How long? 4. Wearily he climbed the steps to his room. His key turned in the lock. His door opened a light of brilliance, and he stepped forward in surprise to confront Colonel Bertrand. The old man was seated in the easy chair, his elbows resting on the table as he faced the poet. "Pardon the intrusion, boy," said the colonel. "I use a skeleton key to enter. I could have waited outside for you, but I prefer remaining some place where I am locked in." His voice was so grave and his face so serious as he spoke these last words that Bertrand accepted their import without questioning. He framed a reply. He wanted to inquire why Bertrand had not left town, if it had indeed been he whom the poet had seen leaving the museum a few hours previous. But the older man lifted a hand in a tired gesture and motioned Bertrand to a seat on the couch. His dim blue eyes stared out from a face lined with exhaustion. "Let me explain this visit," he began. "But first, a few questions. I beg of you to answer these truthfully, my boy. Much depends on your veracity, as you shall learn." Bertrand nodded, impressed by the utter gravity of his visitor. "First," said the colonel, "I want to know just how long you have been visiting that wax museum."
"About a month, in fact. A month ago tomorrow I made my initial visit."
"And just how did you come to go there, of all places?" Bertrand explained the circumstances of the fog, the chance glimpse of the sign with its hint of shelter. The colonel listened intently.
"Did the keeper speak to you during that first visit?" he asked.
"No." The old man started, blinked in puzzlement. He mumbled to himself.
"Strange. Eliminates hypnosis. Latent force in the statue. Never took that rot about demonology seriously."
He checked himself hastily in his glance. But Bertrand's once again he spoke, very slowly.
"Then it was she who drew you back?" There was in that voice which caused Bertrand to affirm the truth, caused him to pour out his story in a ceaseless rush of words, untouched by any attempt at concealment or adornment of the queer tale. At its conclusion, the old man sighed heavily. He stared at the floor for a long time.
"I thought as much, my boy," Colonel Bertrand said. "Your family sent me down suspecting that something, or rather someone, was holding you here. I had guessed that it was a woman, but I never dreamed that she was a woman of wax. But when you took me to the museum and I saw how you gazed at that statue, I knew, after looking at the image myself, I knew and understood far more. And then I heard the tale of the museum keeper. It started me thinking. If I could, with a mind bemused by that damnable beauty of the cursed figure. At first, when I bid you goodbye, I intended to go. Not so much for your sake as for my own. Yes, I shall admit it frankly, I feared for myself. Bertrand, you understand the power that queer image holds over you and other men as well, if the keeper is to be believed. That power is exercised upon me. I was frightened by the feeling. I, an old man long forsaken by thoughts of love, experienced on seeing that red witch." Bertrand stared at the colonel, who continued without heed. "But I did not go back. The next day I returned to the museum in the morning to gaze as you gazed, alone. And after an hour before that strange simulacrum, I left in a daze of wonder commingled with practical alarm. Whatever power that statue possessed, it was not good, or right, or wholly fashioned by sanity. I acted on an impulse. I recalled the story of the museum keeper, this man Jacqueline. I went down to the newspaper offices to search the files. At last I found the case. Jacqueline had stated that the affair occurred many years ago, but he had not said just how many. My dear boy, that case was closed over 30 years ago." Bertrand's gasp was cut short as Bertrand rushed on. "It was true, all true. There was a murder, and the wife of Dr. Jacqueline was convicted of it. It did come out that she had perpetrated 5 similar crimes under various names, and the journals of the day made capital out of certain testimony that was formally disbarred. The testimony spoke of wizardry and hinted that Madame Jacqueline was a witch whose mad butcherings were actuated by a sort of sacrificial frenzy. The cult of the ancient goddess Hecate was mentioned, and the prosecution hinted that the red-headed woman was a priestess of some sort whose deeds constituted a monstrous worship. This offering of male blood in honor of a half-forgotten pagan deity was, naturally, disallowed as testimony. But there was enough evidence to convict the woman of the actual killings. It was fact. Remember? And I uncovered things in the old papers of which this Jacqueline did not speak. The witchcraft theory was not formally recognized, but it got the doctor himself banned from the practice of medicine. It was more than substantiated that he was beginning to indulge in certain practices, encouraged by his wife, little pilferings of blood and flesh and sometimes vital organs from corpses in the morgues. That seems to be the real reason why he abandoned his practice after the trial and execution."
The narrative about obtaining his wife's body from the morgue for sculpturing purposes is not mentioned, but there is an item about the body being stolen, and Jacqueline left Paris after the execution 37 years ago. The colonel's voice was harsh. You can imagine what this discovery did to me. I searched through year after year in the files, trying to trace the path of the man. Never did I find the name of Jacqueline mentioned, but occasionally little disturbing items about traveling waxwork exhibits cropped up. There was a wagon show run under the name of Paliti, which toured the Basque provinces in 1916. After it left one town, the bodies of two young men were discovered buried beneath the lot where the exhibition tent had been pitched. They were headless. A George Balto operated for a time in Antwerp under almost identical conditions about 24. He was called in to testify concerning the case of a mutilated body found in the streets outside his museum one morning, but was exonerated. There are other couplings of disappearance connected with waxworks, but the names and dates vary. Into the later ones, however, the press reports distinctly describe a short, gray-haired proprietor. What does it all mean, I pondered. My first impulse was to communicate with the Surete, but a pause convinced me that, while theories do not concern the police, there was much to be learned. The real mystery was just why men continue to stare at that statue. What is its power? I cast about for an explanation. For a time, I guessed that the proprietor might be hypnotizing his solitary male visitors, using the statue as a medium, but why? For what purpose? And neither you nor myself was so hypnotized. Now, there's something about that image alone, some secret power connected with it that smacks of, I must admit it, sorcery. She's like one of those ancient lamias one reads about in fairy tales. One can't escape her. I couldn't. After leaving the newspaper offices that afternoon, I went back. I told myself that I was going to interview that little gray man, clear up the mystery, but in my heart, I knew better. I brushed him aside as I entered the place and sought the statue. Once again, I stared into her face, and that terrible fascination of evil beauty flooded me. I tried to read her secret, but she read mine. I felt that she knew my emotion toward her, and that she rejoiced in exercising her cold power to will my mind. I left in a daze. That evening at the hotel, while I tried to reason things out, to plan a course of action, I felt a strange urge to go back. It cut across my thoughts, and before I knew it, I was on the street, walking toward the museum. It was dark, and I returned home. The longing persisted. Before I could sleep, I was forced to bolt my door. The colonel turned a sober face to Bertrand as he whispered, "You, my friend, went to her willingly every day. Your torment at her aloofness was slight compared to mine, which I fought against her enchantment. Because I would not go willingly, she compelled. Her anguishing memory haunted me. This morning, as I started here to see you, she forced my footsteps to the museum. That's why men go there. If willing like you, they worship unbidden. If unwilling, she commands and they come. I went today. When you came, I was ashamed and left. Then I came here to wait and opened your door so that I might lock it from the inside and fight to keep from leaving until I could see you. I had to tell you this so that we might act together. What do you propose? Bertrand asked. It was strange how earnestly he believed the other story. He could realize only too easily that his beloved was evil without ceasing to adore her. He knew that he must fight against her siren magic, even while his heart cried out to her. The colonel, he understood, shared his own feelings, therefore he asked eagerly. We will go to the museum tomorrow, the colonel said. Together, we will be strong enough to fight against that power, suggestion, whatever it is. We can speak frankly to Jacqueline. Hear him out. If he refuses to talk, we shall go to the police. I am convinced that there is something unnatural about all this. Murder, hypnotism, magic, or just plain imagination, we must get to the bottom of it quickly. I fear for you and for myself. That cursed statue is chaining me to the spot, and always it seeks to draw me back. Let us clear up this affair tomorrow, before it is too late. Yes, Bertrand, agreed Dolly. Good. I will come for you about 1 p.m. You will be ready? Bowing at Bertrand's nod of assent, the colonel withdrew. 5. The poet worked all that evening on his poem. First, to forget the strange tale of Bertrand, and second, because he felt that he could not rest until he had completed his epic. In the back of his mind was a puzzling suspicion that he must work fast, that matters were coming to a head in such a fashion as to demand haste. He was exhausted by daybreak and somehow thankful that his tired sleep would be dreamless. He wanted to be free of that flame-haired image that haunted him by night, free to forget his terrible bondage to a wax woman. He slept deeply as the sun crept from window to window of his attic room. When he rose, it was with a prescience that noontide had passed, though by this time the sunlight had gradually faded into a mist of yellow fog that grew ever thicker beyond the window panes. Glancing at his watch, he was startled to note that it was already long past 3:00. Where was the colonel? Bertrand was confident that his concierge would have awakened him with a racket to spare should he have a daytime visitor. No, the colonel had not come. And that meant only one thing. He had been called lured. Bertrand jumped up, raced to the door. Hastily he crammed the finished manuscript of his poem into the ulster he donned against the encroaching fog. He took the stairs hastily, then rushed out along the dismal fog-down streets. This was like that first day a month ago, and still he was running to the museum to keep his inevitable tryst with torment. The very moment seemed to make him forgetful of his real errand, the finding of the colonel. Instead, he could think only of her as he rushed through the gray fog to the gray room, the gray man in the scarlet glory of her hair. The building loomed out of the mountain mist ahead. He hurried down the stairs, entered. The place was deserted. The little doorkeeper gone. A strange surmise rose in Bertrand's heart. But it receded before an irresistible urge to commune once more with Salome. The air was tense with a feeling of impending fury, as though the crystallization of some cosmic dread were near. The murderers leered waxily within as he paced down the hall. No Bertrand. Deserted in the darkness, he stood alone before her. Never had she seemed so radiant as today. In the half-light she wavered, slitted eyes shining with wild invitation to forbidden rhapsodies. Her lips hungered. Bertrand leaned forward, staring into that inscrutable, agelessly evil face. Something about her knowing smile of appeasement caused him to glance down, to glance at the silver salver that held the head of John the Baptist, staring still wide-eyed agape, the head of Colonel Bertrand. 6. Then he knew, as he glanced at the mocking smile of anguish, glanced at the blood flooding forth from the slashed neck. Realistic art. The first head a month ago, the second last week, and now the colonel, who felt a flooding desire to return. Young men forever coming to worship her beauty. Newspaper accounts of decapitation tragedies. The beauty of a murderess unveiled in a deserted wax museum. She who had beheaded her lovers for witchery, how often was that head changed? Little gray man crouched at his back, his eyes filled with lead and fire. His hand held a surgeon's knife. He smiled at her, and he mumbled. Why not? You love her. I love her. She was not like a mortal woman. She was a witch, yes. She killed when she lived. She liked the blood of men and the sight of eyes forever fixed in worship of her beauty. We worshipped together her mistress, Hecata. Then they guillotined her. And so I stole the body to model his image. I became her priest. Men come and they desire her, and to them I bring the gift I bring to you. Because they love her, I can give them what I can. The chance to rest their tortured heads within her hands. Wax hands, perhaps, but her spirit is near. They all feel her spirit. And that is why they come and adore. Her spirit talks to me at night and asks me to bring new lovers. We have traveled together many years, she and I, and now we have returned to Paris for new adorers. They must lie in her hands, bleeding and bright, and stare their stare of love forever into her face. When she tires, I give her a new admirer. The colonel came this morning, and when I told him that which I tell you, he consented. They all do. And you shall consent, my friend. I know you will. Think of it. To lie within her pale white hands and stare forever. To die with the benediction of her beauty in your eyes. You will make the sacrifice, won't you? No one will know. They never suspect. You will play John the Baptist. You want me to now, don't you? You want me to... Hypnosis. Hypnosis at the last. Bertrand tried to move. As the voice droned, the eyes stared in glorious pleading from above. And the cold edge of the knife caressed his throat. The blade began to bite. He heard words through the gray fog, through the scarlet fog, as he stared into her face. She was a witch, a Medusa. To lie within her arms and worship as others had worshipped a poet's death. In a moment his head would be resting on the salver, and he could see her as he sank into the dark. He could never possess her. Why live on? Why not die and know her radiance forever? It was easy. Her husband knew, and he was being kind to Bertrand. Kind? The knife bit. Bertrand's hand went up. A sudden horror flickered in his soul. He grappled with the screaming little madman, and the blade clattered to the floor. They fell in a lashing embrace as Bertrand tore at the pudgy gray face, clawed deeply at the blazing eyes. Something deep within him had risen in resurrection. Youth. Sanity. The will to live. His fingers pressed as he shoved the gray man's head against the floor. He squeezed, throttled, until time dissolved in the welter of red anger. When his hands finally loosened, the little maniac lay quite still and dead. Bertrand rose and faced his impassive goddess. Her smile was unchanged. He looked again into her infernal beauty, and his soul wavered once more. Then his hand fumbled at the breast of his ulster, and he gained courage. He drew forth the crumpled manuscript that lay there, his finished poem to Salome. He found matches. He lit the manuscript. It flamed as he held it forth, held it to her flaming hair. Fire mingled with fire as she continued to stare in the way Bertrand could not yet understand, the terrible way that enchanted him and all men and lured him to their doom. Impulse seized him even at the last. He took Salome in his arms, took in his arms as she burned, writhing and moving with fiery life. He held her close for a moment as the glowing flame spread, then eased her again to the stand. She was burning horribly fast. Witches must burn. And like a witch, her dying features changed. They melted into a hideous mass. Her face became a gargoyle horror, a melting, shapeless yellow blob, from which two glassy eyes fell, like blue tears. Her body wiggled in agony as wax limbs slowed. She was real then, real and tortured. Tortured just as Bertrand was as he beheld her waxen agonies. Tortured by fire, but a fire that purified. Then it was all over. Bertrand stared at the man on the floor, still and dead as he lay as the fire began, creeping redly against the fog. It would soon blot the museum out forever, blot out the horror that lured men to a tragic reenactment of an ancient crime. Fire purified. Bertrand stared again at the little pile of melted yellow liquid that lay bubbling and seething as though in some hasty process of putrefaction. He stared, and then he prayed that the fire would mount swiftly. For now, with a gasp of horror, he understood. He knew the mystery of her allure, which had eluded him. The maniac murderer on the floor. He had fashioned the statue from the morgue-procured body of his wife. This he had told Bertrand. But now Bertrand saw more. He knew and guessed the secret of the statue's evil power. There is a miasma of evil about the dead body of a witch. Bertrand turned and ran sobbing from the redly ravaged room. Ran sobbing from the sight of that yellow bubbling pile of melted racks, from which protruded the charred, bony skeleton of a woman that had served as the statue's frame.